This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today has been described as an underwater Audubon. But putting any label on James Prosek is difficult. Artist, writer, and naturalist, those are the words he uses to begin his own official biography. Prosek is a curatorial affiliate of the Peabody Museum of Natural History at Yale and a member of the board of the Yale Institute for Biospheric Studies. He's published more than a dozen books. The first when he was just 19 years old, still an undergraduate at Yale University. He's also written for the New York Times and National Geographic. His watercolor paintings, which I can tell you personally, are beautiful. They've been shown at the National Academy of Sciences and at renowned galleries around the country. He's also a musician and a Peabody Award-winning documentarian. The two things that tie together all of these diverse works are fish and fishing. Prosek's two most recent books are Eels and Ocean Fishes. James Prosek joins me now from a studio at WSHU in Fairhaven. Welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, James, your most recent book and a current exhibit here in Woods Hole is Ocean Fishes, and it features 35 fish that you've selected. So what was the criterion? What makes these 35 fish, what are they and what makes them important or noteworthy?
Well, I chose the 35 types of fishes because they were fish that were important to humans as food fish or game fish, fish that we commonly hear the names of, from bluefin tuna to swordfish and mahi-mahi. The idea behind the project was to paint the fish not as a field guide representation to represent a species, but to paint an individual fish that I had a personal experience with. So to go out on a boat, see the fish, and paint it life size. So not just as a small little icon, but as to really show the monumental nature of some of these huge pelagic fishes that swim in our oceans. And so, and also to, I see them as almost self-portraits of a personal experience with an individual fish that I saw. And there's a particular moment that I wanted to capture, which was the moment that a fish first leaves its element, the water, and enters ours, the air. And it's kind of lit by its own internal colors, but then when it first hits the sun, it's really kind of remarkable. And I think that's a really important moment in the legacy. Our legacy is as things that eat things in the environment, as predators that live in the air, when the fish first leaves the water.
I mean, as any fisherman knows, many of these fish are very brightly colored when you first pull them out of the water, but those colors, those internal colors, as you call them, fade incredibly quickly. And so what you're showing people is something that usually only fishermen get to see.
Yeah, it's a very privileged view that, like you said, only the people who are on the boat really ever get to see, because the colors fade almost immediately after the fish are taken out of the water. I'd been obsessed with trout since I was about 9 years old, and I saw this over and over when I sort of got a bee in my bonnet to paint all the different trout of North America, that when I'd actually go to these different places where these fish lived and caught them and take them out of the water and hold them in my hand, there was a very brief moment, extremely ephemeral moment, where the fish's colors were still kind of brilliant, but they faded very quickly. And this project, the Ocean Fish Project, kind of appropriately started on the Cape. My mom was living in Chatham for a little bit, and I saw this truck in the Citgo station in Chatham and sort of went in. It was for sale, and went in to inquire about it. And I met this guy named Norman St. Pierre, who a lot of people in the Cape know as someone who owns the Citgo station, but also somebody who is a tuna spotter who goes up in his little plane and spots schools of tuna for harpooners. And I saw pictures of these giant bluefin tuna on the wall of the Citgo station. And I thought, wow, they were like several times bigger than humans, like 800, 1,000 pounds. And I thought, I have to see one of these things, and I want to paint it not just, you know, at the scale of a book, but life size. And so I started talking to Norman, and he invited me to come up one summer in his plane, and then I went on the harpoon boat, and I saw two fish about 750, 800 pounds. harpooned in off Barnstable inside Cape Cod Bay, and I couldn't believe what a remarkable fish this was. It was beyond belief to see something that incredible. And the tuna and marlin and some of these ocean fishes really are, the fishermen describe it sometimes as being lit up. They're literally like pulsing with color and light, almost like they have an internal switch. And when they come on the boat, they're just that light is flickering and changing, and it's unbelievable. And so to capture that is really impossible, because there's no official way that a tuna or a swordfish or marlin looks. You have to sort of make, as an artist, arbitrary choices about what moment you want to freeze and what characteristics you want to show. So I don't pretend that these paintings are literal interpretations or literal representations of these fish. They're just personal interpretations of these fish.
Now, you do your painting actually from photographs that you take when you're out on the boat, because of course you couldn't possibly paint in that speed and that scale that you're talking about. So talk about, I mean, especially with the tuna, and you say these paintings are a personal experience with one particular fish. So talk about the tuna that you ended up painting and what that moment was like and how you tried to capture it.
Well, when you're on a commercial boat, and I found that sometimes it was very hard to get on commercial boats because these people are trying to do their job and they don't want some stupid artist just hanging around, you know, potentially getting seasick or, you know, causing trouble. So you first sort of have to earn their trust with your, and I found just by showing how passionate I was about these fish that usually, you know, eventually they would let me on board. And, it's with that particular tuna, there's a lot going on when a fish that big comes on the boat. Well, first of all, you know, Norman, there's a lot of excitement because after 5 days of fishing, Norman finally spotted a school of giant bluefin tuna. I forget what the cutoff size is for a giant tuna, but over maybe 450 pounds. And for the whole week, we hadn't seen that much. I'd spent 2 days in the plane and 3 days on the boat. And many people on the Cape know what these harpoon boats look like, but there's a maybe 40-foot boat with a platform, they call it a pulpit, about the same distance off the bow of the boat where the harpooner runs out, grabs a spear. And when the plane directs the boat to where the school of tuna is, the harpooner runs out at the end of the pulpit and literally throws a spear by hand at a fish and going, you know, pretty fast. The boat's moving pretty quickly. And it's a very adrenaline-filled, exciting moment. If you have any interest in the history of predation, it's really kind of a throwback to whaling days. And then these days, the harpoon head is connected to electrical source on the boat, so they electrocute the fish immediately, and it comes up. And they bring this massive fish in, like an 800-pound fish is just a really impressive creature. They drag it onto the deck, and it's pretty much total chaos. They're trying to, drain the fish of the blood and preserve it as well as they can for the market. And you just don't want to get in their way. But so I try to capture as much as I can in that moment, not just with photographs or video, which are very helpful, but also later when the fish is, if I have some time with it, I take tons of measurements, do a bunch of sketches in graphite or watercolor. But really the most important component is, to me, is memory of the experience of being there. And no photograph can capture that, and no measurement can do it. But all these little things are aids to remembering what it was like to be there. And I really try to make these kind of experiential pictures. And so there is much about me as the fish, and in my mind at least. Obviously, when people see the fish on the wall, they're like, oh, that's a fish. but you know, the other idea was, besides trying to capture that moment when the fish is in its glory, in my mind, or in that peculiar moment when it's out of its element and in ours, I think what I wanted to do was just show people how gigantic these fish are, And painting them life-size was one way to do that. So then I go home with all this material, and I lay out a big piece of paper on the floor, and I get to work, and that's pretty much how it comes about.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with James Prosek. His latest book and current art exhibit is Ocean Fishes. Now, James, I've seen a video of you online actually to show just how large that tuna was, crawling out onto your painting laid out on the floor and laying down on top of it. You know, and you say you fit perfectly within the tuna. I mean, but that seems to speak to a relationship that you have also with your paintings. I was a little surprised to see you literally crawling on and laying on your your beautiful life-size watercolor painting of this fish.
Well, to me, the pictures are pretty durable as long as you don't throw a bucket of water on them or bleed on them, which sometimes happens if you prick yourself or get a bloody nose while I'm painting. But so there's some detritus from just being on top of the picture sometimes. I try to keep the surface as clean as possible, but painting on the floor in my studio has wooden boards, and sometimes you can see the line where the boards are. I put something underneath it, but it does make an impression of the floor sometimes on the paper. But, you know, to me, those are all part of the picture. And I like working flat. Anything that's bigger than my desk, I work on the floor. I work at all different hours of the day in different moods. And a painting like a tuna or a swordfish can take 2 months. So there's a lot of different kinds of moments that that happen and during the course of painting it that I personally remember that nobody looking at the picture would ever remember. But so it's such a commitment of time that's another reason why they feel so kind of personal to me. But I really do love these fish, and there's so many pictures of fish out there. There's a lot. Before I saw a swordfish, and I went on a harpoon boat off of a town called Woods Harbor, Nova Scotia, and we went out on George's Bank. You know, the captain of the boat had described to me, once I told him what I wanted to do, paint a fish, life size, he said, there's a blue on swordfish, on the back of the swordfish, that you've never seen on land. And he said, you never seen a blue on land like the blue on a swordfish. And if you ever met a girl with the eyes the color of a swordfish, you leave whoever you're with and go with her. And he had a whole spiel about this purple-blue color on the swordfish. And I have to say, I've also been blessed to meet people who have been willing to share their time with me and show me their view of what these fish are like. And they really, even a hardcore commercial fisherman who you may not think would care about art necessarily, they care deeply about it. And they really, once they kind of understood my mission, they made it a point to sometimes show me these fish that they'd spent their entire lives with, that they know that nobody else really knows what they look like because they just aren't there. You really have to be there on the boat. So I was trying to capture that moment, like you said, that's very privileged that only the fisherman has. Usually, now, the photographs really can't capture.
Now you know we've talked about tuna, swordfish. You also did a marlin. These very large, kind of charismatic fish. But I was struck that you also chose the scup, or also known as porgy, this very small and I think sometimes, I don't know, perhaps underrated fish. So what went into choosing that particular fish?
Well, some of them were fish that I had nostalgia for growing up near Long Island Sound, fish like blackfish and bluefish, and we call them porgies or scup. It's funny how the local names are different in different places. But one of my favorite fish, hands down, to look at is a black sea bass, which they get really nice specimens of off of the Cape and Westport, Mass, and the Elizabeth Islands. And that's just such a gorgeous fish. And that was probably one of the fish I enjoyed painting most. And it's a It's a fish that's not often celebrated for the way it looks, but more the way it tastes. Yeah. But same with like a Nassau grouper. They're just really beautiful fish. I mean, also is for me, painting all these fish is just an excuse to spend time on the water because I feel like my trips need to be purposeful sometimes. And so it was just a fun, really fun project.
And your paintings of the fish, you don't just paint the fish. I mean, you've mentioned these different locations you went to, and you've traveled all around the globe painting different fish. And the ocean fish paintings are accompanied by these smaller paintings of invertebrates, whether it's mussels or crabs, and sometimes the plants in the local area that I think in seeing those other parts of the environment along with the fish gives the fish that we often see, you know, as we've been mentioning, only cut up as fillets in the store or something, a real sense of place in the world.
Yeah, I mean, those elements kind of anchor the corners underneath the fish. So they create, they're meant to create a kind of pleasing triangular composition, which is kind of classical. But also, like you said, to acknowledge that there's other things in the ecosystem that these things are connected with. Not just in the water, but on the beach, too. There's a lot of beach plants, beach plum or rose hips or, you know, wild persimmons or things that might grow close to the coast. And I really believe in the interconnectedness of the land and the sea, and that these creatures don't live in their own little boxes. Even though the way I paint them sort of suggests they're kind of isolated on a blank background with the environment removed. But I'm also interested in, and I'm currently writing about how we name and order the natural world. I'm writing a book about this. And those putting the other elements in the picture kind of also are a commentary on how humans see nature in a hierarchical way. So the fish is on top and the beach plum and the crab might be at the bottom, but the crab could have been on top and the fish on the bottom. You know, it's just kind of my personal prejudices and perspective that put the fish on top. So it's kind of acknowledging that too, that we have these prejudices about what is more important in nature, which piece of the puzzle. But one of the things that really taught me encouraged me to look into the interconnectedness of things in nature was the eel, which I know we might talk about later, but has a huge influence on my life, just the way it connects the ocean life and the freshwater life and is this kind of thread that ties both ecosystems together.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is James Prosek. We will talk about two of his favorite fish, both with freshwater connections, trout and eels, after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is James Prosek. His most recent book is Ocean Fishes, but his first book had a distinctly freshwater bent to it. Trout, an Illustrated History, was published when Prosek was just 19 years old and still an undergraduate at Yale University. We invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook. Now, James Prosek, you've said that you were obsessed with trout since you were about 9 years old. What was the connection? What drew you to that fish?
Well, I was introduced to nature through my father's love of birds. He grew up in South America and fell in love with these tropical migrants when he moved to originally to New Rochelle, New York, from Brazil, called warblers and other tropical migrants. And so I grew up looking at these little colorful things in the trees, and my first paintings were of birds. Partly because of my father's passion and copies of Audubon's paintings of the birds of North America. And then around the age of 9, a friend of mine at school, who was a big troublemaker but really liked fishing, introduced me to bass fishing, and we would fish in golf course ponds and at the reservoir illegally. We have these drinking water reservoirs in the town I grew up east in Connecticut. And then he took me to a little stream at the north end of one of these reservoirs, and I caught my first native brook trout. And it really, it kind of blew my mind that this extremely colorful creature with, you know, yellow spots and red spots with blue halos and these kind of olivey worm-like markings on the back. It looked like a tropical fish, that this fish lived in these dark tannic streams near the house where I grew up, within walking distance of my home. And I started painting them, and they were kind of similar to the warblers, these birds my father loved, because they were very colorful. And you kind of needed to know a little bit about their habitat in order to see them. They didn't kind of give themselves up that easily. And trout, you can't just walk up to the bank and of the stream and observe them. They scatter. They kind of get spooked easily. So for whatever reason, I absolutely fell in love with these fishes, and I can't really explain why. I mean, it's just kind of, they really, these little gorgeous fish completely took over my life from about 9 to 25 years old.
Now, you published your first book, you were still an undergraduate, and was, as the name and the title implies, an illustrated history of trout. But then you went on to write a couple of other books, Joe and Me and Early Love and Brook Trout, that really mixed our interpersonal relationships, themes of friendship and love, with this theme of kind of ecology and fishing and fish. So what's the connection there for you?
Well, you know, it's true. I mean, it wasn't really just the fish. I mean, the fish was, I don't know. I don't know why I put all so much love and passion into these fishes, or how this little young body had that much love for these things. But I also had developed a love for the people who I learned things from, who were part of the environment. And one of those people was an outdoor mentor of mine named Joe Haynes, who was a game warden for the water company. And he caught me fishing illegally when I was 14 in one of these reservoirs, and kind of became an important force in my life. And I wrote this book about him, Joe and Me, in Education and Fishing and Friendship. And yeah, there's no separation between the love of the fish and the environment in which the fish lives, and the people who also love these fish and love them either. I used to catch these poor little fish, torture them, take pictures of them, and let them go. And Joe Haynes was always, the game warden was always telling me, you know, why do you let them go? It's food. You know, you should keep them to eat. And he claimed that he fished for the pot, not for enjoyment. And so I started to examine my own practices, even at 14 years old. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's okay to keep one of these once in a while to eat. But it was an interesting kind of conflict between our philosophies. But you know what, later on in this eel book that I wrote, it's about eels, sure, but it's really about the human relationship to eels, how eels make us feel, what mystery means. There's just all these things I'm trying to kind of get close to that are really intangible, and I think the root of a lot of them is with the fish thing, is the surface of the water. And like I was talking about with the ocean fish, I don't know why, for me, that the most important moment is the moment that the fish breaks the surface of the water. Because as a kid standing at the edge of a pond or a reservoir, it was always about wondering what was beneath that surface. And it was an element that I couldn't live in. Even with scuba gear, you're not really living in it. You're just sort of a visitor underwater. And the surface of the water reflects our world back to us, and also abstracts that world in the waves, and it obscures the world that's underneath the surface to us. So I still, you know, that space between air and water is a source of endless fascination to me, and really one of the main I think, sources of my inspiration for my artwork and my writing. And preserving the mystery of what's underneath the water. So the trout, you know, you never knew how big they were out there, what could be living in the reservoir, even sea monsters, I mean, or lake monsters or reservoir monsters. It was all possible. And in my work today, there's sometimes a fantastical element or an imagined element, because I don't really believe in pure documentation of nature. There's no such thing. If you're drawing nature, you're interpreting it. And so the line between real and imagined is already blurred. And when I'm making a painting of a swordfish, I would never, or any fish, I would never presume to say that this is an official representation of this fish. It's a personal interpretation of usually an individual fish, and that's the best it can be described as.
Now, you have said that you think we are most efficient as predators when we love what we're hunting, and you've mentioned your love of the brook trout and these commercial fishermen who I don't think we typically think of commercial fishermen as people who love the animals that they are harvesting. Where did that idea that there's this relationship between love and hunting come from?
Well, I also really believe that as someone who draws things in nature, that drawing is a way of becoming a more efficient predator, because there was a moment when I was painting trout, or many moments where if it was I was painting a fish that I'd caught myself, if I sat down to draw that fish, or when I sat down to draw that fish, I was completely reliving the entire experience of catching it. So drawing the fish was a way of internalizing the experience in my head, but also getting to know the characteristics of that fish much more intimately. And then I felt like when I went out fishing again, that through this close observation, having to really look at something through drawing, helped me become a more efficient predator. I say predator, it's sort of a crass word, but someone who likes to pursue things, even if I was letting them go, it's still a predatory act. It's something I think that's in us from our days when we had to capture and kill things to survive. Of course, we no longer do, most of us in the world. There may be some hunter-gatherer societies out there that do. But I really feel like art and predation have a strong connection, and that these drawings in cave walls from 40,000 years ago in France and Spain are records of that that process of internalizing a creature when the creature wasn't in front of us. It was a way of communicating something when it wasn't there, and strategizing in a hunt. But as far as commercial fishermen loving what they're catching, the ones that I've been in contact have a very deep knowledge of the things that they're catching. They have to, and a lot of them really do seem to love these fish. They also love hunting. A lot of the guys on this harpoon boat in Nova Scotia, they were all turkey hunters and deer hunters, and I have trouble killing things sometimes, but I believe in having a connection with nature where you can sometimes take something's life and eat it yourself, and it's every part of that process can be very meaningful if you come about it in the right way. Of course, there are people who are also probably more not as sensitive about the process, but those people, there's always outliers.
Do you ever keep and perhaps cook and eat what you paint now, or do you always still let it go?
No, I do. I keep fish to eat, for sure. I don't fish as much as I used to, but occasionally, once a year in the spring, I try to go fishing with a friend and have what my friend Joe Haynes called a spring tonic, which was a dandelion salad or some spring green and a fried brook trout. And that was somehow a way of bringing in the spring.
Sounds like a wonderful tradition.
Yeah.
Now, you have more recently really become enamored of the eel, the freshwater eel, and this is not an animal that many people find easy to love. So what has drawn you to the eel?
Well, yeah, I mean, growing up and then after having done these two books on trout of North America and trout of Europe, Asia, and North Africa, where I traveled a lot to try to document these different types of fish, I started paying a little more attention to this other fish that lived in a lot of these freshwater systems, the eel. And I knew a little bit about their life history, or the story that some, you know, a lot of us encounter at some point, that these fish are born in the Sargasso Sea, this area of the North Atlantic, and they spend their adult lives in fresh water. And the life history of the fish is what kind of blew my mind, that there were eels in the pond across the street from the house where I grew up in Connecticut that were born like 1,000 miles east of Bermuda in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, in the western part of this subtropical gyre, big swirling eddy in the Atlantic called the Sargasso Sea. And I just wanted to know more about them. And specifically, I mean, I wrote a book about them in part because I had a quirky editor at HarperCollins who was willing to embrace the weird subjects. I was visiting him on the travels for one of my books in Italy, and it was Christmas Eve, and there were these stakes sticking out of the water in this lake called Lago Trasimeno. And he said, "What are those stakes?" And I said, I think they're marking eel pots, and they're trapping eels for Christmas because the Italians like to eat eels. And I said, you know, the eels in this lake in Italy were born in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean in the Sargasso Sea. And he didn't really believe me. And when a couple months later, he read this essay that Rachel Carson had written. I think it's in her book, Under the Sea Wind, about a female eel named Anguilla, and she was imagining this journey that one female eel made from the pond where it had lived its adult life out to the ocean to spawn and die. And he sent it to me and said, "I think this could make an interesting book." So, you know, I started digging deeper into eels, I just couldn't stop thinking about them. They're really fascinating fish, and what's really great to me is that although I really enjoy the whole enterprise of scientific inquiry, we still have never been able to witness the spawning of freshwater eels in the ocean. We don't have the technology to track a fish the size of an eel out to the middle of the ocean through several hundred meters of water, maybe 1,000 meters of water. So the spawning ritual of the eel is still a mystery to humans, and I think that's kind of a beautiful thing. We don't have to know everything.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with artist, author, and naturalist James Prosek. More on the mystery of eels after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is James Prosek, artist, author, and naturalist. He started off writing and painting trout. He then moved on to ocean fishes, but along the way, he discovered the freshwater eel. And James Prosek, you say that this fish has become something of a totem for you. Why? What is it about the eel that you identify with so strongly?
Well, there's a lot of things I'm attracted to about the eel. And one of the reasons I also wanted to write about them was because I'd spent so much time with these fish that people feel are conventionally beautiful, the trout. And when I started talking about eels, a lot of my trout friends were like, "Ooh, eels, like why do you want to go from like painting the most beautiful fish in the world to painting or looking at or studying the ugliest fish in the world?" And I felt like eels needed a little PR boost or something. But I one of the things that attracted me to the eel is that they don't fit into any neat category in our minds. They're kind of, they're a fish, but people sort of think of them as snakes because they have these long, sinuous, limbless bodies like snakes. I like things that are kind of, that make us a little uncomfortable sometimes, that are at the outer edge of what we would consider something that fits in a box. So it's they're also quite beautiful swimming in the water. They have this beautiful kind of sinuous movement. But I also like that they've been able to keep their life history a mystery from humans, and that we don't really know that much about them. Once they leave fresh water for the ocean, we can't make really any significant observations about them. And these long migrations they make are kind of inspiring. I became, you know, when I started the project, I didn't know anything about the importance of eels in the cultures of different people around the world. But as it turns out, or as I found out, eels are one of the most important creatures in the nature-based faiths of a lot of Pacific Island people, in particular the Maori in New Zealand. Eels, as with snakes, kind of inspire fear and awe and reverence in people the world over, whatever it is about this shape, this limbless bodied creature. It shows up in a lot of world mythology, and apparently the people that left the mainland and Indian and then in Indonesia and traveled out to these outer islands and populated them over time, they came with stories where the snake played the role of the monster seducer or the guardian, like the snake in the Garden of Eden. And when they came to some of these islands, most of them don't have any native snakes, so the eel was the closest available counterpart. It looked like a snake, and it replaced the snake in a lot of the mythology. There's a whole world of strange eel stories out there.
Well, and I mean,
as you may be able to imagine,
there's in many cases nothing stranger than reality, and they do manage these almost magical seeming feats. I mean, you've mentioned the migration back out to the Sargasso Sea, how these fish find their way to each other and the right spot in the ocean remains a mystery, that literally that scientists don't yet know how they make these migrations. But then they also, in just getting back to these ponds, as you mentioned, you sometimes find them in a completely landlocked pond. It seems almost magical that these fish are somehow making it across land into completely isolated ponds.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never seen a fish feed out of water until I saw these eels in New Zealand, where these Maori people have ponds where they've been feeding them, they say, for hundreds of years. And they'll, if you sprinkle some dog food on the lawn, they'll come out of the stream and eat on the grass. And it's kind of freaky, but they do on wet nights, they can travel over land. You know, not miles and miles over mountains, but they can cross farm fields. And in New Zealand, during big rains, these farm cats go out in the paddocks and they'll catch eels and bring them back, you know, to people's doorsteps, like cats bring back birds in the U.S.
That's really incredible.
So,
I mean,
they have, you know, it's a fish that can breathe cutaneously through its skin. It's just bizarre in so many ways, and I love that it challenges us in our view of what a fish is. It really pushes the limits. That's kind of what I was trying to say before, and that it doesn't fit in the neat little boxes that we want a fish to fit into.
Well, and as a result, throughout history, it's been misunderstood even by some of the great thinkers in science. I mean, Linnaeus, who, you know, created our entire system for categorizing life, didn't really know where to put the eel.
Yeah, well, I'm not a big fan of Linnaeus. That's a whole other story. I am in some ways. But yeah, I mean, nobody knew until the 1920s where eels reproduced. Aristotle thought they emerged from the mud. Isaac Walton, one of my favorite writers, wrote that eels were generated from horsehairs that fell into puddles of water at the right time of year when the sun was slanting from the right direction. There were all kinds of harebrained pseudo-natural histories about where eels fit, how they generated, mostly about the reproduction of eels. I'm not sure how Linnaeus classified them, and it's possible that he probably thought they were fishes, but perhaps didn't know what they were related to. There's only a handful of these eels around the world that have this lifestyle of spawning in the ocean and spending their adult lives in fresh water. They go the opposite direction of every other migratory fish. All other migratory fish, salmon, shad, striped bass, are what they call anadromous fishes that spawn in fresh water and live their adult lives in salt water. And the eel goes the opposite direction, and it doesn't just go 10 miles off the coast. It goes like 1,000 or 1,500 or 2,000 miles from the river where it spent its adult life. And they're really cool.
We mentioned that eels often have a reputation for being ugly, but you have found a way of painting eels that is incredibly beautiful, and it goes back to a form of fish printing, essentially inking fish and using them to paint, that you found goes way back in Japanese history, just as the associations with eels do.
Yeah, I first went to Japan to look for a native trout to paint for my Trout of the World book, in particular in Hokkaido, the northern island north of Honshu. And I had seen what they call gyotaku, or ink prints of fish, before, but I really had a more intimate glimpse of the process of this Japanese technique of taking a fish, putting ink on it, and usually using rice paper, putting rice paper on the inked fish and getting an impression from it. And I imagine it started as a kind of, not necessarily as an art form, but just as a way for fishermen to document their catches, and then kind of developed into this craft. So as I became more interested in eels, I thought, well, I'll start taking eels and put ink on them and stamp them over and over on the paper. So I kind of use the eel as a brush to make these big, sometimes large, gyotaku pieces. They're not really exactly the way that traditionally gyotaku were made, but I'd never seen anybody use eels before, and I thought they would make really cool looking pictures. But usually people use fish that have big scales on them because they show up better on the paper. But eels have a neat, they have very tiny, tiny scales that are not visible, but they have a cool pattern on their side that shows up when you print them.
Well, and you say you sometimes ink them and then use the same eel after that just one inking multiple times. And as you put it to the paper multiple times, the image changes from something very solid to something very ethereal, and you get different textures. I mean, it's really the differences that come out with that different amount of ink are incredible.
Yeah, so I'll take an eel and rub the slime off of it. Unfortunately, it's dead at that point. And I take a black foam brush and dip it in ink, and I ink the eel. And then I put it on the paper once, and then a second time, and a third time before I re-ink it. And the second and third impressions, as you say, are a little bit more ghostly. And when you build up the, you know, hundreds or even thousands of impressions, you get kind of a little bit of a depth kind of effect. I've done pieces with, you know, that I've kind of estimated I stamped the same eel 5,000 times, over several days. So building up all those patterns. And what I really, you know, wanted to create was the kind of movement of water with using a fish that evolved in the water. So the eels are fish that physiologically apparently haven't changed much in 200 million years. They just maybe were really suited to living in water from the moment they kind of came about. And so they really are, and I've said this before, but they really are kind of the, to me, the manifestation of water. They move like waveforms or like currents, and they're probably extremely efficient swimmers.
Well, and your paintings, these with the many, many eels stamped onto these large, large paintings, to me, the closest thing I could compare them to are actually videos that, you know, go viral on the web all the time of, there was one recently of a school of anchovy near the coast of California, or these very large flocks of birds that you do get that sense of movement from your paintings with these eel prints.
Oh, that, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I want to try to express is this mysterious amassing of eels in the ocean that humans have never seen. And when they aggregate to spawn, I imagine they get into big sort of balls of thousands of individuals and just release their eggs and sperm in a big eel orgy. And it must be kind of, if you could actually witness it, like these aggregations of sardines or grouper spawning, or different fish or birds that flock or aggregate at certain times of year. It must be a really quite a spectacle to see, but it's probably in an area of the ocean that's really dark at night. And I'm not sure it's something humans can witness, because if we ever turned a light on, they might scatter. But yeah, I do love seeing those formations of creatures as you describe.
Now, you clearly learn a great deal about the ecology and the biology of the fish that you paint and appreciate that. I wonder if you ever felt that you had a choice to make between making the kind of inquiries you do as an artist and perhaps pursuing a career in science.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. My father started as a merchant marine. He shipped cargo around the world and was at sea a lot. And then when he started having a family, he retired and became a science teacher. And he taught astronomy and earth science. And he raised me in our house. Darwin was kind of like God. And he was reading these popular evolutionary biologists of the day, Stephen Jay Gould and E.O. Wilson. And he was always talking about a lot of the time about biology and the wonder of how things evolve. And so that really had a huge impact on me. He recognized that I had a love of drawing. I loved also architecture and drawing. I used to make up buildings and draw all kinds of stuff. But he always kind of said, you can't be an artist for a living because it's not really a job. And he was kind of raised in a very pragmatic way with a Czech father. If different courses had been available to me at different times and I'd been kind of inspired by particular professors or teachers, maybe I would have gone into a life of science. But I really fundamentally, I think I have the temperament of an artist. I don't want to be constrained by processes and have to rely on data that I have to find in the real world.
All right.
Because I believe so strongly in the power of the imagination.
James Prosek, thank you.
Thank you very much.
James Prosek will be at the Cape Cod Museum of Natural History on July 25th and the Woods Hole Historical Museum on the 26th. You can find links to more information on our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Joelle Schrock at WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut, for production help with today's show. Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.